The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 191 for Monday, February 9th, 2009.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. That's John Braun, and no, it's not Arbor Day.
What? That was Pete's question.
That's right.
It was Groundhog Day, but no more.
But no more.
I think he still was wrong. I think he's off, man. It's getting warm. At least for me.
Yeah, that's right. We had 50-degree weather yesterday. We opened all the windows in the house, which is great, airing it.
Oh, yeah.
Out. Yeah, that's a good thing to do.
So we shake our fist at you, Phil. You're wrong this time.
You know, I think we're going to have to let Phil go.
I know Lisa's been talking about that. Well, why not?
Free Phil, right? Can we start the Phil campaign?
If somebody would like to, I'm going to. If anybody can draw nice logos, if you could draw a Free Phil logo for the next Groundhog Day,
oh, that'd be great.
We would sincerely appreciate it.
Oh, that'd be great.
T-shirts or something, man.
Every day's Groundhog Day for Phil.
Well,
unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right.
I heard he nipped his handler, which showed his displeasure.
Go, Phil.
Dude, if I was hibernating, I'd be really upset if somebody kind of reached in a hole and grabbed me. I mean, it's just.
Is this going to be the Groundhog Day Geek Gab? Is that where this is going?
Play the song again like we did.
No.
Okay, on to the show.
You know, so this weekend, actually, while I was at Macworld Expo, a Drobo and a bunch of drives showed up. And, you know, Macworld Expo is a crazy time. So since I've been back.
Drobo, I remember they're a vendor of, I believe, like kind of RAID type, very cool.
Yeah.
I think, but you had to check it out. So Drobo, we saw them at the show and they were a hit, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So they actually last year won a TMO. We gave them a TMO Editor's Choice Award for the Drobo itself. And then I wanted to check out the Drobo Share. But I'd researched the Drobo itself, I'd never used one personally. So it's been sort of an interesting experience. So, yeah, the idea behind the Drobo itself is that it is a RAID enclosure or a drive enclosure, I will say, that you can connect to your computer. The current version either uses USB 2 or FireWire 800.
Good.
And it mounts as, in most cases, you're going to mount it as a single volume. So you've got four drive bays in this enclosure, and it's all eSATA drives. And you can put, the cool thing is, you know, there's lots of RAID enclosures out there. The cool thing about this is you don't even need to know that the thing uses RAID. You don't even need to know what RAID is in order to use this enclosure. What you do is you buy the thing, you hook it up to your computer, you start plugging drives in, and you go. And the more drives you have in there, the more storage that you have.
Okay, well, I want to qualify that a bit or ask you a question. Mm-hmm. So RAID, there are multiple, RAID means a lot of things. So RAID can start at the lower levels, I believe, or like 0 or 1 or 2, which involves kind of rudimentary stitching of drives together and maybe in some cases striping them so multiple drives are available for writing data. And then you get to, I guess, error correction. So I just want to zero in on what you're talking about now, which I think to me sounds like the more basic things. You plug in a drive, it adds to the array, and you're happy and you don't have to, you know, run a silly utility to make that happen. Is that in the ballpark?
I'm glad you asked. The answer is very complex and very simple all at the same time.
Excellent.
Yeah, and this is part of what makes Drobo magic. So the idea is, in a typical RAID enclosure, you have to use two drives or all the drives have to be the same size in most cases. Right. So what you're going to do is, you know, you get maybe 300-500 gig drives or, you know, whatever you want. And then, and if you have two drives, you know, you would set up a RAID array to be what they call mirrored, right? And the idea behind RAID is to either extend your storage beyond the capacity of a single drive or protect your data by having some sort of fault tolerance, right? And so with two drives, if you want to do fault tolerance, you mirror them. If you put 500 gigabyte drives in a typical RAID enclosure, you get 500 gigs of storage. And if one drive fails, you're totally fine because your data is all on the other one. If you have more than two drives, you can use what's called striping, where it starts putting the data across all of the drives. And if you do striping with parity, and I believe I'm getting this right, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, striping with parity provides that error correction that would allow, if you pull one drive out of the array, you can then replace that drive and you won't lose any data because the data is striped with parity across all of the drives. And so it can rebuild the data that was on the missing or failed drive.
Okay.
That's typical RAID. We still aren't talking about the Drobo yet, but I believe RAID, that's typical RAID.
Well, I think what you said before, so I'm sorry, I was tuning out a bit, but what you mentioned before with three drives, yes, the parity drive will, from what I know, redundantly it will back up the data on one of the other drives.
On both, on all of the drives back each other up. You don't have one drive that's just for parity. You have all of the drives for parity.
Now, so, the lower levels, but I don't know if you said, but on the lower levels, if you pull a drive,
where were you?
It's confused. Yeah, it was off in Skype land.
Okay. So that's what goes on with a typical RAID array. Now, the way the Drobo works, you can put drives of different sizes in, as long as they're all eSATA drives, they work. Drives of different sizes, and the Drobo, and it's important to listen here, and the Drobo magically goes through and uses different types of RAID on the different drives. So, and this is much more easily explained with a picture, but I'm going to do my best to explain it here. Let's say you have a 1 gig drive, and then 2 500 gigabyte drives. Sorry, you have a 1 terabyte drive and let's say 2 750 gigabyte drives, right? So you've got three drives in the enclosure. Well, actually, you know what? Back up. Scratch that. I have a better way to explain it. Let's say you have 2 terabyte drives and 1 500 gigabyte drive in your enclosure. So three drives, 2 1 terabyte drives, 1 500 gigabyte drive. The 2 1 gigabyte drives, the section of those that matches the 500 gigabyte drive, so the first 500 gigabytes of all three drives will be striped with parity. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now you've got this striped array with parity on that section of all three drives. Then the portions of the terabyte drives that are left over are now mirrored to each other. Because that's the only option for those. So the Drobo looks at what you have and dynamically assigns and reassigns if necessary. If you put a new drive in, it will kind of rejigger the whole array to maximize the storage space available while still maintaining fault tolerance in case one of the drives fails. So still, even in that setup, any one of those three drives could fail and you wouldn't lose a stitch of data, which is pretty freaking awesome.
Okay. So it really takes, because RAID is typically, and I believe the Apple Disk Utility will let you, if you're brave enough, lay out your own RAID array. But unless you have what I think you're hinting at, Dave, an intimate knowledge of what RAID 0 and 1 and 2 and 5 and 10 and whatever the heck else is in there and what they entail, it sounds like they make their very best effort to make you or help you set up the drives in a fashion where, you use all the space. And I guess if you choose, you will have redundancy, so you will not lose the data.
You don't get to choose. The redundancy is built
it
in.
So they do not let you back off to a lower RAID level that is just for growing a partition. Okay, well that's awesome then. So it's a guaranteed, as far as long as their hard drive doesn't melt, right, then you're cool. Okay, that's awesome. So, yeah. so that is the strength of this product, is that it will do its very best to make sure all your data is redundant and backed up, and you just plug the drives in and it. So I assume, and your feedback on the utility. So I imagine if you plug in another drive at some point, it says, okay, what do I do with this? Do I make it part of?
No. It doesn't do a darn thing.
Nothing?
It doesn't ask you a darn thing.
Or does it just glom that drive onto the capacity and include error recovery, you know, all that stuff?
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. Now,
there you go.
It's good.
Dude.
It's good to remember, or it's good to know, that with any sort of fault tolerance, you do not get to store all of, you don't get the grand sum total of all of your drives available for storage, because you need something available for fault tolerance.
Right.
And the rule of thumb, and again, the prior example kind of speaks to this, but the rule of thumb is that you take your largest drive and subtract that from the sum of all the drives, and what you have left is your storage space. So if you have a 1 gig and 2 500 gigs, you're going to have 1 gig of storage available, but it's going to be backed up. If you have 3 750 gigabyte drives, you're going to have about a terabyte and a half.
Okay. So I guess what you're saying, if you want to get down to the metal and you want to do the low level RAID stitching, kind of seat of your pants, no error correction thing, this is not the way to do that, because I think it's assuming you want to be safe. But if you want to, I mean, there are people, there are a couple of geeks out there, I think, who want to do the raw stitching thing, which I guess other enclosures would allow you to do, where you could build your own solution.
Correct.
Okay. So this is plug and play, very reliable storage. You just pop the drive in, it grows it, you're cool. That's outstanding.
So that's step one. And as I said, the setup is very easy. When I popped a new drive in, I had already configured, I put 2 drives in, I configured the thing because I wanted to see how it worked.
Okay. And, do they have a utility, or is it transparent?
There's a utility. Okay. So I put the drives in, you launch a utility that lets you set up how you want to set up the Drobo. Now, out of the gate, you're defining a single volume that your Mac will see, or your PC, it'll work with Windows. And so with the utility, you decide what size you want that volume to appear to be. I chose 4 terabytes. Now, I don't have 4 terabytes currently in the Drobo, but at some point I may. And so I chose to go that high. You can go as high as, I believe, 16 terabytes in the current Drobo utility. So once you did that, and I also, through the setup and through the utility, I put in that, I want alerts emailed to me. And so I put in my email address. And then when I put the third drive in, the Drobo, it's got a series of lights on the front. There's one light per drive, and the light can either be, I think, red, orange, or green. And so I put the drive in. Now, mind you, I did this while it was hot. So the Drobo was on. It was connected to my computer. I was copying data to it.
Okay. Was this a drive that was like out of the wrapper?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
I took a new drive. I popped it in.
Unformatted.
I popped it in. It took maybe 10 seconds and the light turned green. And within about 20 seconds, the Drobo utility was reporting, got this other drive and it's ready to go. And so now you have this much more storage. Wow. Yeah, it's great. And I'll speak to the lights on the front of the device. So you've got these lights that kind of tell you the state of the drives. I think red means there's a problem. Green means everything's good. And orange or yellow means this drive, you should either add more storage here, or this particular drive might be on its way out. So, you might want to replace it. Hmm. It's also got, across the bottom of the unit, a series of blue lights that... And I know you with menu meters, John, you're going to like this. There are 10 blue lights that Pete's correcting me here. There's 10 blue lights across the bottom that show you in 10% increments how full your Drobo is. So if 2 lights are lit, it means that 20% of your available storage is being used. So it's pretty cool. So that's the drill boat. Now, speed is something we need to talk about here, because so far it's all been roses here. The speed of the drill boat didn't blow me away.
In theory, well, some raid, and it sounds like they're mixing raids, but in theory, some lower raid levels, the end result is you get a speed boost. Then, of course, you have, and I'm sure you'll comment on this, but the bus speed. So you have bus speed, drive speed, and combined drive speed, and I'll hand it back to you.
Yeah. So with this, I don't think it's the drives that are slowing things down. I think it's the raid technology and the various different types of raid. Now, I've got three 750 gigabyte drives in the Drobo. So I've got a terabyte and a half, essentially, of storage available. And presumably, the three drives are now striped with parity. But speed-wise, when I'm copying data to it, it maxes out in that 11 to 18 megabytes per second. So, more than 100 megabits a second, less than 200 megabits a second is what I get. Now that's, and I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit.
Okay.
Here.
Are you,
but that's
networked?
either connected with FireWire 800 or networked. And I'm going to talk about how I'm networked in a minute here, but initially it was FireWire 800 connected direct to Intel iMac. And that's where I was maxed out, and the processor wasn't maxed or anything. I mean, it was, definitely the speed of the Drobo. And I looked online because it seemed kind of slow to me, and I looked online, and sure enough, that was sort of the report that I saw everywhere. So, so then I pulled the other thing out of the box, and that was the Drobo Share. Now, the idea behind the Drobo Share is pretty straightforward. It's a little network adapter for the Drobo. You plug the Drobo via USB 2 into the Drobo Share, and then the Drobo Share has an Ethernet port on it as well. It's actually got two USB ports, so you could plug two Drobos in, and that's important to note.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the Drobo, does not have an Ethernet port.
Mm-mm.
Make sure. Okay, it has USB and FireWire.
And FireWire 800, that's right.
Okay. So go on.
Yeah, no, the Drobo Share is $200, and that then essentially adds an Ethernet port. Now, it adds a whole lot more as well. The Drobo itself is $500 just for the enclosure with no drives in it whatsoever. And then this Drobo Share is $200, I believe. I've got that right. And that adds Ethernet to it, so you can network the thing. Now, that's the cool part. The not so cool part about the Drobo Share. And then I'm going to get back to an even cooler part about the Drobo Share. So bear with me here.
I have an uncool part, but I'll let you go first.
Okay. It only supports SMB, which is the Windows Networking Protocol. So it does not natively support Apple File Protocol. This means, in my experience anyway, that it does not show up in the shared list automatically. The only way I was able to connect to it was by going in the Finder to the Go menu, choosing Connect to Server, and then manually typing SMB:// and then what I knew to be the IP address of the Drobo. Now, of the Drobo Share. Now, the Drobo utility, the same utility that I used to set up the Drobo when it was connected to my Mac, found the Drobo Share no problem. And I was able to set it up. I could even assign it a username and password, which I did. It's a single username and password for full access to the device, which isn't great, but I think that's pretty common with consumer grade network storage devices, though not all of them. So that's that's sort of the drawback, is that you're connecting via SMB and you have to do this manually. Now, of course, once you connect once, you can make an alias or whatever you want and connect with a double click down the road. But that was sort of the drawback, was this, it's not AFP. And so, not so happy. Now, I'm going to get into a little bit more, but let's talk about the Drobo. You said you had a question.
Well, the one question I had, so USB 2 is 480 megabits, right?
Yep.
FireWire is 800 megabits, and gigabit Ethernet is
1,000
megabits. Right. So Would it lead? It would lead me to believe that it could be a bottleneck, perhaps.
But
because you were talking about performance,
if you note, if the Drobo is connected via FireWire and only doing a maximum of 180 megabits. We're not even getting close to the speed of USB 2, let alone the speed of FireWire or Gigabit Ethernet.
Okay.
So, yeah. And indeed, my speed tests showed no difference whatsoever copying to the Drobo or from the Drobo using via the Drobo share versus FireWire 800 direct on the Mac. It was absolutely the same. It was as though it were connected. So for better or for worse. Right. The time capsule, I should note. Now, of course, the time capsule only has one drive in it. The time capsule usually sits in the 20s, sometimes, you know, bumps up into the low 30s. Sorry, usually see in the 200s in terms of megabits. Sometimes I see it, you know, push 350, but I've never seen it push 400. I think that's pretty common too. So now the cool part about the Drobo share and the real reason I wanted to check all this out, though everything else is cool. And now that I've, you know, had a chance to play with this thing and geek out with it a bit, I can't imagine not having it, by the way. But the Drobo share is a little computer essentially that runs embedded Linux, not unlike our Linksys routers and all that stuff. Right. So what the Drobo folks decided to do was, instead of having people hack their way into it, they decided to open it up. And so there are many little, what they call Drobo apps, that can be installed into the Drobo share, letting the Drobo share be its own type of server. One of those apps is an AFP server. So you can set it up to talk on the network as an AFP device. Now, the way the server is, it's very restrictive in terms of how you have to have your Drobo set up ahead of time. I did get it working a little bit, but it was sort of flaky. You have to name your Drobo Drobo. You can't name it anything else. And you know, there's a couple other things you have to do, but it works.
What you said, AFP is Apple File Protocol, which is pretty much IP Apple talk.
Right.
Just for the junior geeks out there.
It's how all your Macs, if you have multiple Macs networked together, or if you have a time capsule or something like that, it's the protocol that they're going to go ahead and use. So so there was an app to do that. There's an app to get an SSH terminal session in direct into the Drobo share. There's one.
Nice. Secure shell.
Yep.
Cool.
There's one to enable jumbo Ethernet frames that they said would improve the speed. I didn't see a whole lot of difference, but I turned it on. What the heck? There's one called Firefly, which is an iTunes streaming server. So you could copy all your music files onto the Drobo, and then it essentially announces itself on the network as another copy of iTunes out there, and you can stream music from it. Yeah. So there's lots of cool stuff available. I'm hoping to find, you know, something that would let, you know, my TiVo stream direct from it so that I don't have to go via the computer. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities out there, and the Drobo apps make it cool. So that's definitely something where we're going, you know, definitely going to play with that. And I'm going to see if it's possible to compile a Drobo app and how difficult that is. So, yeah,
go for it.
Yeah. It's cool. So,
all right.
So that's the Drobo.
I want one.
It's cool. It's fun. I have to say,
I'll call them.
It's expensive. You know, it's $500 for the Drobo itself, right? I mean, is that what I said? Yeah, $499 for the Drobo, and then I think I said $199 rather for the Drobo share. Is that right? Pete's saying it's pilot proof. Pete, you've had one for a while, right?
I have, and I love it, and I have really gooned up some network drives before and had to go back and try and recover data. I had one using the Riser file system, and that was an expensive recovery. This thing, you know, once you format the drive once, plug it in, it's just like an extra drive. it like a Mac, it just works.
Yeah.
It's I've got nothing bad to say about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. It really does. I mean, you know, when I explained it to Lisa, it's like, oh, it lets you stack drives together. She's like, oh, well, that okay. Like, but you don't have to know how to do that. You just plug them in. She said, anytime I want. I said, sure. She said, can I take a drive out? I said, sure. But, you know, it's going to yell a little bit, but it'll it'll keep working. And you just put another drive in. You're good to go. So, yeah, I know it's cool. Yeah. And the Drobo share. So it's not cheap, but at the same time, for what you're getting, it's unparalleled. You can't get this anywhere else. It just works. But being able to just take all of any spare drives you have laying around and shove them into this thing and just have it work, it's pretty darn cool. Is it worth the $500? Well, yeah, because where else are you going to do this?
I use mine for the time machine mainly. I have other stuff on there too, but that's where my time machine backup is.
You could goof around with this utility and try to figure it out, but...
Yeah, I guess. Anyway. Good luck with that.
I don't think it'll let you break it, though.
You mean use disk utility to try and figure the Drobo out? Or use disk utility in place of it? Yeah. Of course.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of course. Yeah. So, yeah, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. So I'm looking forward to more Drobo apps coming out and more people doing that, because I think there's a lot of opportunity there. So it's a fun little thing, and it works. Yep. I guess we'll talk about, are we done with the Drobo? Do you have any other questions, Sean?
Gimme.
No, I can't.
Give me one.
I need to keep working with it here.
Well, maybe I'll get my own.
Okay. All right. Our first sponsor for this show is Barebones Software with BB Edit. Now, BB Edit 9 has a couple of things going on. They've added integration with MobileMe. So if you have a MobileMe account, you can keep your BB Edit preferences and your entire application support folder synchronized across machines, which allows you to preserve your text factories, your clippings, and more. BB Edit is an awesome text editor. I use it to build the HTML for our show notes. I use it when I'm editing PHP. If you program in C, Java, JavaScript, it's got profiles for just about every language I've ever heard of. And the way it works is, as soon as it realizes what language you're using, it starts doing text formatting and different colors and all that for, you know, various functions and tags and all that, to really give you a visual representation of what it is you're doing. It all happens automatically. A couple of things in BB Edit 9, the find and replace windows are now modeless. It used to be that when you were in BB Edit and you tried to do a find, you couldn't leave that find window up and go do something else. You had to finish what you were doing in the find window, close it, and then you could click on another window. Well, now that's no longer the case. You can leave them up and do different things and then come back. If you do a multi-file find, or you've got a bunch of files open, you can edit those files right in the results window. So you're not just seeing them, you can edit it now. Huge time saver, and being able to do that and then save works great. So this is BB Edit 9 from barebones.com. It is $125 for an individual license, or if you're upgrading from a previous version, $30. And if you're a student, it's $50 for a full version. So that's BB Edit 9 from Barebones Software. Is it time to move on, John?
I'm going back to school.
Are you really? You're going to get a PhD?
I was thinking, you know, actually, to be frank, I was thinking of graphic design, perhaps.
Really?
Or journalism. Who knows?
Cool.
Make life interesting.
Cool.
Anyways, Gene, is Gene?
Gene. Yeah, we have some follow-ups from prior shows.
And we love them.
A couple of them. A couple of follow-ups from a couple of different shows.
Because you get to shake your fist or wag your finger at us sometimes.
Yeah, or whatever.
Or help the community.
You got it. So Gene writes, the discussion about Vista file sharing with Macs brought back memories. All of your theories were most likely wrong, at least to the extent that Vista is out of the box, unable to connect with Mac OS X. It is still true that Vista is unable out of the box to connect with Mac OS X. We were just wrong in terms of why. As Gene says, Vista requires and defaults to NTLM version 2 network authentication, which Mac OS X does not use. A registry patch to Vista fixes this. And Gene went ahead and gave us a link that will teach you how to do this. It's a very simple registry patch. And Gene says, I use Vista all the time with my Macs, and once patched, file sharing works just fine. This applies to Windows 7 as well. He says, one gotcha of most discussions tell you is how to fix for the various business flavors of Vista, which is fairly easy, but the technique is unavailable for the home versions. A registry patch is needed for those. And like I said, we will share the link. So thank you very much, Judith.
So we did see, though, he mentioned, and actually he linked to forms which suggested that you could go into, I guess, if you have admin, to go into the security policy portion of Windows Vista. And they have a section where you can indicate which authentication protocols you would like to use. So it's something
that's the business versions, but the home version.
Okay, the higher level. Okay,
yes,
yeah. you're correct. Yeah. So yeah, and you've been there, and I've been there, and Geeky, you know, people have been. But if you have admin rights, typically, or a sufficient level of Windows, like I run XP Pro, still for my day to day work doing development, I don't trust Vista, but that'll be part of a future show.
All right. Should we move on to Jason?
We shall.
Okay. Jason writes, regarding your Slingbox Airport wireless bridge discussion near the end of Mac Geek Gab number 190. Thank you, Pete. Apple shows such a setup in Knowledge Base article HT2044, and we'll put a link to it. The title is Using the Airport Admin Utility to Create a WDS Network with Multiple Base Stations. In the article, there are airport base stations connected as clients, AirTune sharing, and bridges for a wired client to an existing airport base station network. It does not mention third-party Wi-Fi networks, but a point-to-point bridge setup should work. The base stations can connect to existing Wi-Fi setups like any client and then simply turn on bridge mode. And he puts a airport article or knowledge base article HT1731 Airport Express, how to join an existing wireless network in client mode. So that would be the one to use with your third-party network. So thank you very much, Jason, because that answers not just Pete's question, but we had quite a few people email in and say, oh, yeah, me. So,
well, a question.
Yeah.
Maybe not the question.
Okay.
Should we go here?
Where are we going?
Sorry, folks. I pulled a pin on that question and rolled it in. Here it comes.
Well, no. To me, this indicates you can do the sharing if your Airport Express is part of another network, right?
Right.
Okay. But I guess the question that came up, and maybe we'll follow up on this because I have not yet tried it. If you just have an Airport Express, can you share a connected device on the Ethernet port wirelessly? And I think that's still up for debate, though we've had some people saying, I think you can do that.
So again, this is only for there is no existing wireless network. You're looking to use, in essence, your Mac connecting directly to an Airport Express.
Correct.
But the device on the other side of it is not an internet connection. It is, you know, a printer.
It is. It has an Ethernet connection, but not an ISP. So
right.
It is an Xbox or this or that. And I think we got to follow. But we had some questions.
I don't think we need to follow up. I think that's totally doable. You'd have to put the thing in bridge mode and manually assign IP addresses on both sides. And then it would definitely work.
Do you think so?
Yeah. Why wouldn't it?
You're right. No. we talked about it beforehand.
Yeah. No, it definitely would.
But we have two distinct questions. Do you want to extend your existing network, or do you want the Airport Express to be basically a little hub?
Mm-hmm.
Or a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is what the name of it is.
Right.
But the answer is, which we got from multiple people, was, dude, I do this. So Right. Yeah, we had one person say an Xbox and another. So any Ethernet, mostly any Ethernet device can be shared with that.
Yep. Cool.
Got it.
We will go on to Mr. X, I believe.
Yes.
Hello, gentlemen. Apologies if this question's been asked many times. But a few episodes back, maybe it was more than a few, Dave mentioned a program that allows him to bring his MacBook home and he plugs into the network. Then based on the different nodes and equipment on his network, it determines the laptop is at home, and so it automatically sets his home static IP. I'd like to do something like this for my MacBook Pro, so when I go from a client's office to back to my home office, I can have it, say, detect my HP printer and my time capsule and automatically set the correct IP for me. Sorry if this has been asked a lot, but if you could just give me a quick shout in the show as to what that program was, I'd be forever grateful. Thanks, guys.
Hey, you bet. And of course, that was the audio was stuttering a little bit there, and I think we might still be stuttering a moment here. All right, we let it calm down a bit. First, I will answer his question, and then I will speak about the stuttering. The answer to your question, sir, is Marco Polo, and we will put another link in the show notes. But that's the app that I use. You set a bunch of criteria. And you say, look, if you find a printer on the network named this and you see a device named that and you're connected to this particular keyboard or that particular mouse, then boom, you know, you can believe that I'm on this network. So, yeah, it's Marco Polo. Now, about the audio stuttering, I had previous, and it's funny, we were talking about this before the show. We haven't had this issue in a while. And we were talking about it before the show. And Pete said, you know, now, of course, Murphy's Law will come and get you. And Pete, you were right.
Sorry, man. I'm psychotic.
Thanks, man.
This
yeah. So I had initially thought, you know, it was about the time we moved from using a G4 PowerPC machine to record the show to an Intel iMac to record the show, that this problem cropped up. And so, you know, I always thought, well, it's the audio buffers on the iMac. Well, at about the same time, not exactly, but right about the same time, I also went from using iTunes to play the comments to using Yojimbo. Now, iTunes was sharing the library from my MacBook Pro down in my office, and Yojimbo was sharing its library from my MacBook Pro down in the office. So I didn't think much of it. But there is a notable difference. The one difference is that the audio comments playing in iTunes across the network were not being read from the local drive. Now, in Yojimbo, the iTunes comments are being played from the local drive. So we are reading from the local drive while we're recording and writing to the local drive. So I've got to do something, and maybe on this machine, maybe I'll make use of this Drobo somehow to put the comments out there, and that way we're reading them across the network, and hopefully that will keep this from happening. Though I have to say, this is the first time in over a month that we've had this problem. So anyway. That's where we is at.
Anyway, the poor man's way of location intelligence, should we call it that?
Okay.
Is network, location. Hey, you see a location menu. Edit locations.
Right. And
you got to do it manually, which is, yeah, a pain in the neck. And yes, as you're pointing out, I'm just pointing out the basic alternative.
Right. Well, you still need to define those locations with Marco Polo.
Yes.
And then it just automatically sets them for you is what it does. Yeah. All right. And then one last follow up from a prior show. And thank you so much for writing in, Alex. Yes. Alex writes, while listening to the podcast, you were talking about when you download the podcast directly to an iPhone or iPod Touch, you can't put the device to sleep while keeping it playing. And this is because there's a bug in the iPhone firmware and the iPod Touch firmware that causes some podcasts when downloaded to incorrectly be tagged as videos, and the iPod or iPhone will not play a video when you put the screen to sleep. So Alex says, well, I think I figured out a backdoor entrance to play it. After downloading the podcast, start playing it and then put the device to sleep. The podcast will stop playing. But then press the home button twice and a menu comes up and you can click play. The podcast will play and you can put the screen to sleep. Thank you so much, Alex. I tested this on my iPhone. It works flawlessly. So for all of you folks that download the AAC version of the podcast direct to your iPhone and then hate having to keep the screen alive and simply look at the logos or the various bits and pieces of the AAC file, if you just want to listen but you don't want to have to sync to your computer to do so, this is how you do it. You put it, you start playing, you put it to sleep, it stops, you double tap the home button, and then you get a play icon on the screen, and it totally works flawlessly. So thank you so much, Alex. That's awesome. You know, John, we have a question from Kenny, or at least by proxy from Kenny. Yeah, about playing podcasts on an iPod, and so I thought it was a good little dovetail to go from prior to the new. Watch this. Mm-hmm. We just segue right in. Kenny writes, Jane, who lives in Australia, is a loyal listener of yours and just about all Mac podcasts. She's having a problem. I've been trying to help her to no avail, but my efforts thus far have spurred me on towards finding this holy grail to solve her problem. To wit, Jane has an iPod Touch, and all of a sudden she developed a problem that defies fixing. Now, whenever she plays a podcast and it comes to an end, the next podcast in her queue starts playing automatically, just like a music playlist. Jane, like many of us, listens to podcasts when she retires in the evening, and thus she doesn't want the podcast to play one after another. If they do, they are considered listened to. So if she nods off, listening to podcasts other than Mac Geek Gab, obviously, she'd like the podcast to end and have the iPod go to sleep, restarting her podcast listening anew the next day. We have tried checking to be sure that the podcasts are classified as podcasts in the genre field and checked the repeat settings, etc., all to no avail. She's using a workaround of turning the iPod sleep feature and having it timed to approximately the end of whatever podcast she's listening to. Any ideas you might have would be appreciated. Ah, yes. So this is interesting because something that used to happen and people
used to.
Yeah, it used to be something that happened all the time. And people were sad when there was the firmware update for the iPod that turned this off. And in fact, many people went on to then create smart playlists so that their iPods would continue playing podcasts one after the other. And this would be handy if you were playing a series of podcasts that were all, you know, less than 10 minutes long on your commute. You didn't want to have to keep pressing play on your iPod. So they actually turned this off, or they made a way that for most people turned it off automatically. And I think Jane messed with this setting on her own and didn't realize it.
In my experience, I tested this and I tried our enhanced podcast and it merrily marched from one to the other.
Right. Just as Jane describes. That's the problem. She doesn't want it to do it. And as Jane describes, it didn't used to. And she did not update her firmware. So what did Jane do? Well, I'll tell you what Jane did.
Tell me.
Jane disabled shuffle mode. Strange as it may sound, by disabling shuffle mode, it turns this off. Now, if you enable shuffle mode, either song shuffle or album shuffle, it totally it totally changes this behavior, and podcasts will stop playing after the show finishes. Again, if you want to have shuffle mode enabled and have the podcast played together, you need to create a smart playlist to do that. But otherwise, that Jane, that is your answer. So go ahead and turn on shuffle mode, song mode, album mode, and that should do it for you.
How dare they?
Do they dare?
They did.
Yes, they did.
Poor Jane.
Poor Jane.
Oh, you know, and Jane and others, well, I don't know if we should go here.
We should go here. Yeah, go.
How to talk to us?
Yeah, that's good. It's a good thing. We want people to be able to talk to us.
I want you to call me and Dave.
Wasn't that a cheap trick song? I want you to call me, right? Anyway, 206-666 Geek is the number to call. And that number, John, is, say it quick, otherwise I'll start singing
4-3-3-5.
Thanks. Feedback.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You say email. It. You say it. You say it. Email.
Feedback at MacGeekAb.com.
Say it again.
Feedback at MacGeekAb.com.
Testify, brother.
Amen.
Say it again.
That type of
Come
show.
On, one more time. Go ahead. Go ahead. Just for me.
Pete.
You
give it to me.
Feedback at MacGeekAb.com.
That's the email address to use, folks. That's right. You can see the
Skype,
show.
Allegedly. Dave, can you comment on this? People have been complaining.
I can comment on it. You Skype to MacGeekGab. I can't comment about why it doesn't work for some folks. I refuse to even speculate. So we like the iTunes comments too, but probably not the best place to leave your question for the show. And then you can see the show notes that John prepares so beautifully each week at MacGeekGab.com.
So. Slash. Oh, no slash. You're right.
MacGeekGab.com will get you there. MacObserver.com/podcast will redirect you around to there. So,
yes, sir. In the show notes, did we talk about that? Nah. Or the enhanced?
Huh? Mm. What are you talking about?
What's next?
Okay. Pete says he has a related question. So instead of making you wait till next week.
Sorry to do that. No, as far as James, the related question as to the podcast, not to get them to stop playing or to play, but as you know, with one of the latest updates, they changed the order in which they play.
Right.
Used to play oldest to newest, now newest to oldest. Most people were smart enough to change it. Some of my podcasts haven't changed their episodes. Is there a way to go in and edit that data to change the release time of a given episode so I can get it in the proper order?
To change the release time of an episode?
Yeah, the publish time or whatever. Can I get in that file and change it somehow?
Well, let's open up iTunes, shall we? Mm, now sure. Now it's like Mac Geek Gab Live. It feels like Mac World Expo all over
Sorry,
again.
Guys.
We're doing a show. Pete's interrupting.
It's my job.
No.
No, of course you can do get info.
Yeah, but that's not going to let you change the time, the release date of the show. I mean, that's published out there. Yeah, you'd have to make the smart playlist, right?
Yeah.
And turn it around. Or like you said, go in and
try to figure out how to edit the file data, and that wasn't working. It was just a...
Okay. Yeah, I wonder if...
Somebody out there knows.
Yeah, wait a minute. If you do... Hang on. If you do track number... Okay, so if you go to, in iTunes, out to podcasts... And you go to the view menu and go to view options and then check the track number field.
Okay.
Then you can sort by track number. Oh, I say that you can. And now I lied.
Yeah, track number.
You lied.
Yeah, but you can't sort
by. Well, there's also get info, but right. No, there's a lot of info counts. There. So let's flog Pete and move on.
No. But the get info doesn't let you edit that. That's the point here. But yeah, you can add the track number. The only thing that you can sort by is the release date. So yeah, so you've just got to, that's the answer then, is just change the release date. Sort option. Click on the little triangle.
Up and down.
Next to release
date.
Will
it change the play order when it hits my iPhone?
It should.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it will. Yeah.
So one will be right and all the others will be backwards.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be the magic answer. Yeah, because the iPhone and the iPod take their play order from how you have iTunes set. If you've got a playlist in iTunes that's set alphabetically, then that's what you're going to get when you navigate on the iPod or iPhone. If you have it set to, you know, by song length, you're going to get that, but you're not going to see it. You're going to wonder, you know, what the heck am I looking at here?
Right.
So, so that's going to be your magic answer. Yeah. Let's talk about Rob, John. You had a conversation with Rob on Twitter.
Yes, and it was a good conversation, and I solved a problem.
And the problem.
So, Rob was saying, I got a problem here. I'm trying to, when I launch all my other apps, and I click on a URL, you know, for a website, it launches my default browser, which is Safari. Now, you may ask me, John, how do you know about the default browser? Don't even think about it, guys. Okay, so you go to Safari, you go to Preferences, you click on General. Default web browser is a field in the General panel in Safari, and it will show you, you would think, either Safari or, in my case, at least on some machines, Firefox or IE or Opera or whatever the heck. So the problem that he had was when he was using Twitter applications, some may be based on Adobe Air, which is what Twirl and others. I personally like Twirl. They're making a lot of advances. But anyway, so the problem was when he clicked on a URL for a website in Twirl applications, it would launch Firefox. And he's like, what the heck is this? Because I said my default browser was this. Why are you not listening to me? And the thing is, so I suggested to him, well, dude, check out, RC default app, which is a pref pane that we talked about before. It's called RC default apps, or it appears as default apps in the other section of your system preferences. But it lists a whole bunch of categories that underneath the covers, OS X will use to figure out what an application should launch if it has a certain whatever. And that's the thing. It could be a URL. It could be an extension on the file. And what he found, I believe it was in the extensions portion of this app, is that applications that had a HTM, I believe, suffix, for whatever reason, were set to launch Firefox. And apparently the Twitter apps he was using were keyed into that particular suffix on a URL. So he basically wrote back to me saying, that was it. I found the app or the extension that was set to Firefox that I did not want, that was now my default app. So I guess what it's saying is that there's a deeper level in OS X where things could get confused, because in this case, obviously, the default browser app was not the default browser app, depending right. on what the application you're using looks to determine, okay, I have a .htm file, I have a file with a MIME type, I have a file with whatever, what do I do with it? And OS X has that capability, but it's, as RC default app will show you, it's scattered about in so many places. So in this case, he stumbled across. Now, the thing is, somebody must have changed that. I don't know if it was Firefox or another application, said, hey, you know, when you see this, launch Firefox. And he had the remnants of that. Fortunately, RC default app, get it. I believe it's free. And it's great. And it helps you understand the whatever.
Yeah.
The gears, the underlying structure of OS X and how it figures out what to do. A lot of times it gets it right. Sometimes it doesn't. And this was one of the unfortunate cases. So now, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, and go.
I wonder if he had gone into that preference pane in Safari and set the default app from Safari to Firefox and then back again, if that would have also changed the HTM handler, or if it only changes the HTML handler or whatever it was.
I don't know what app he was using for Twitter, because that was the app that launched the erroneous web browser. So it depends on what.
You don't understand my question.
No, I think I'm following. No, I think I do.
No, go. Does Safari, when you change the default app in Safari, does that go and update the HTML
suffixes.
Field?
Okay.
Right.
Okay. No, I understand exactly.
Okay.
And I don't think it does. Okay. I think they are separate areas of the OS that figure out what to do with a file. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, so
but he solved this problem. He found it. No, I got to give our friend credit that he found the specific setting that was wrong. So
cool.
But it was quite an adventure. And it did this peg the geek meter? I don't know.
All right, we have one. We'll do one final question.
Think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Michael writes. Let's see. What is all this? Oh no, I put the wrong thing in here. You know what? We're gonna skip Michael because actually, yeah, I'll paraphrase Michael's question. I put the wrong PDF in the show notes. So Michael wrote in and asked, he said, look, in Leopard, I have two questions. One, when I mount a volume, it doesn't appear in the sidebar of my Finder. The server to which the volume is attached appears, but I want to see the volume itself. And then as a related question, how do I go and auto mount this volume? You know, once I get it mounted, that's great. But once when I restart, I got to go back through the process of finding it. And then even still, it doesn't appear in the sidebar of the Finder. So I think we each have a piece of the pie here for Michael.
Yes.
The first piece of the pie, getting it to appear in the Finder sidebar, is something that I've been through with the Drobo. And because now I've got it connected to the Drobo share, and the Drobo share, once connected, appears in the shared section of Leopard 10.5's sidebar. But that's the only place I can see it. Now, the drive itself appears on the desktop, but I can't always see my desktop.
That's crazy.
Now, this is how Leopard deals with network shares. It's not just an SMB thing. It would happen that with sucks. Anything. Yeah, it does. But what you can do is take the, get the share connected, then go to the desktop and find the drive or the volume and drag that volume into the sidebar, into the devices section. Now, as you're dragging there, you'll see it alternate kind of as you're dragging up and down in the list between highlighting one of the existing devices and then putting a little line between them. Let go of the mouse when it's on one of those lines, and it will drop the little drive right there. And in my experience, when I come back around and reboot and it reattaches to the drive, it reappears in the devices section. So I can use it just like a regular disk. It appears there. It's in the open and save dialogues. It's exactly what I want. So that's the magic way, is drag it from the desktop into the devices section. Stupid, unintuitive. It's not how it's supposed to work. And yet it's our lot in life. So, so that's piece number one. Now, piece number two, when he reboots, he doesn't want to have to go through the process of reconnecting to whatever server it is that's got this drive. He just wants to auto connect. And John, how does he do that?
Well, I think it was a disk image he was thinking. Yes.
It might have been. I thought he was talking about network devices.
Okay, but it could be anything.
Yes, anything.
So check it out, yo.
Yeah.
All right. So system preferences, accounts. Click on that.
Yeah.
I'm clicking on it right now.
Yep.
You will then get on the left side of the pane the accounts. If you click on login items, and this will cover actually a couple of things. So you will see a lot of things, and probably all of the things you see will have an item name, hide, which if you want to hide things, and a kind. Now, the thing is, the kind is usually application, but if you drag a disk image over, which I think was part of the request, or a network share. And this gets kind of squirrely, and I'm actually looking at a few programs to do this. But if you drag either a disk image or a network share into the login items window, they will appear there. And guess what? When you reboot your machine and it logs in, it will mount the disk image. It may ask you for a password, which, of course, you can say answer yes forever, or a network share. Though there are better ways, again, of mounting network shares, I think, and I have a few utilities I've been looking at which make it better. So you can do this, and it's really, Dave, to me, non-intuitive that you can put disk images and network mount points or share points in the login items. But
it's true.
It does work.
Yeah. Once you know that you can put them there, then, of course, it makes sense that that you can do so. But up until that point, it is completely unintuitive. So, it's one of those things. The answer is really easy once you know it.
Yeah, because you just said, and I think I tried it once. I dragged over an icon and it didn't give me the little, prohibited icon. And I'm like, cool.
Well, so that means that it's slightly intuitive, right? If you thought you could do it and then you did it, right? Right?
Yep.
iPhoneAlley.com and the iPhone Alley podcast, available there or in iTunes, are the home of Michael Johnston. And he, of course, has converted this show to AAC for your pleasure. It's not Michael's fault that the AACs show up on your iPhone or iPod Touch as video files when you download them directly, by the way. It's not our fault either. It's Apple's fault, and we're trying to see if CacheFly can change something on their end, but the way they send the files looks pretty good to me. So, and speaking of CacheFly, they do provide all the bandwidth that gets the podcast from us to you. The podcast marketplace this month includes the A5 and A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit 9 from Barebones Software, PDF Pen 4 from Smile on My Mac, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. Do we have anything else to talk about, or are we getting out of here quick?
One thing.
Yeah?
You remember that guy we were following? Again, I hate the Twitter stuff, but sometimes
it's
fun.
Oh, yeah, we should talk about our Twitter names.
Remember our real Sean Hannity guy?
Yeah.
He's a fraud.
Okay, good.
He admitted it to me.
Okay.
So he was saying, yeah. Anyways, dude, you got your 15 minutes. Bye.
Bye.
Anyways, Twitter. Yes, I am John F. Braun. Dave is Dave Hamilton. Michael is, I believe, Michael Johnston. Pete is Pilot Pete.
And that's right.
And tweet us. And I love Twitter as we did in this show. I amazingly solved the problem via Twitter.
And you can
medium.
You can follow Mac
TMO.
Observer at Mac Observer at Twitter, you know, at Mac Observer. And then our deals on the website, we rebranded this week to Deal Brothers. Many of you may have seen it. And of course you can follow Deal Brothers on Twitter.
Really?
at Deal Brothers.
Who are these brothers?
Jack and Jim,
speak
man.
To them.
Jack and Jim, go speak to the brothers. There's a deal sister all right. there. All kinds of great deals happening.
Sisters?
It's all good stuff. So
that's excellent.
And you can also follow the Dalai Lama, the office.
Well, he's following a lot of people, which kind of creeps me out, man.
The office of the Dalai Lama is OHHDL. So there you go.
That's all I got.
Yeah, let's get out of here.
Yep. What's tonight? 24?
24.
Heroes.
Big Bang Theory.
Maybe.
Oh, yeah, Big Bang.
I like them. But Heroes, I think all of them. Oh, the Heroes guy. Yeah, we'll link to him maybe. He tweets. The mind reading guy.
Yeah.
Parkman. Yeah.
He knows you're gonna do it.
And Pete, I'll say this to the folks that you mentioned. Don't get caught.
Made up.